Council, please be aware Justice Pierre-Louis may participate in this matter as well by watching the argument. We'll take appearances of counsel.
Deputy Ethics Counsel Hillary Horton on behalf of the Office of Attorney General.
May it please the court, Robert Dunn, Hanlon, Dunn, and Robertson.
And that's Mr. Rave next to you. Mr. Rave, you'll have the opportunity if you like, because this is a potential disbarment case, to address the court last. You need not do so, and you can consult with counsel before making that decision. Ms. Horton.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The OAE continues to recommend respondents' disbarment in this serious criminal matter involving both the possession of child pornographic images and criminal sexual contact with a minor. The DRB issued its opinion and recommendation on March 20th, 2024. The board was split 4-4 with one member absent. Four board members recommended respondents' disbarment, while four board members recommended an indeterminate suspension. The facts of respondents' matter are a combination of the facts involved in the Cohen matter and the facts involved in the Walters matter, with some variation. The reasoning of the four members of the board that recommended disbarment is memorialized on pages 37 through 44 of the board's opinion. And the OAE wants to only point out a few points there that it agrees with and thinks are particularly persuasive. Respondent's crime involved an actual child, and it was actually ended up being four different identified minors, leaving aside the pornographic images, of which 83 were found on his personal laptop computer. Pursuant to In re Gallo, 178 New Jersey 115, on pages 119 through 120 from 2003, the court need not turn a blind eye to relevant information in the record that illuminates the respondent's true conduct or nature. Thus, the court should consider both respondents' conduct on Omegle, which was the live video cam site, which encompassed the four live victims, and was activity that took place over several months' time, and the fact that he separately possessed 83 images of child pornography on his laptop computer. The OAE agrees with the four board members here that are recommending disbarment in that respondents, and this is a quote from their opinion, that respondents' two distinct modes of child sexual exploitation merit nothing less than disbarment. And that is a quote from page 42 of the opinion. Thus, unless there are any questions for the Office of Attorney Ethics, we'll submit on the record below and the board's opinion, the four members that recommend disbarment.
I have a question for all who will address the court today. The court has as a primary concern in these cases, whether there is harm to a child. And I ask in this case, with an individual exposing himself and masturbating to multiple minors online, is there harm to the child present?
I mean, absolutely. The record will show that there were four, the investigation uncovered four 14-year-old minors that were exposed to respondents' conduct. And I don't really think there's any way to argue that that is not extremely harmful for someone of that in that age bracket to be exposed to that kind of direct activity from an adult.
Is there any testimony about harm to the minors themselves? I thought that the juveniles varied in their reports on having even remembered anything about it.
I don't think that we have testimony. We certainly don't have something like at the sentencing transcript where you have a victim impact statement. We do not have something like that in the record. But I will just analogize to the discussion in Cohen, where you have victims that they took pictures of them, and the pictures have existed sometimes for decades. And the court has said that that is harmful to those child victims, even though it may be decades later that those images are still being shared different ways. So I think it certainly isn't any jump at all to say that, masturbating in front of a live victim is harmful to them. And we know from the Walters case that, the court has considered similar conduct. Of course, the difference there is it was not over the internet. It was in person, in real life, I guess you would say. But, that case discusses the types of harm that this can cause to the child as they develop.
I think we're all agree that there's plenty of evidence that exists that these types of matters can cause significant harm to minors. usually the state, when they're prosecuting these cases, will develop victim impact, will develop, you know, statements from the victims of the videotape recordings of their statements. Was any of that included or submitted at any point, reviewed as part of this case?
Certainly wasn't part of the sentencing record. I mean, I don't know, not being involved in the criminal investigation and doing it as a motion for final discipline, I'm looking at the record that exists at that time. I don't know what interviews were conducted with AH and the other three victims. I don't know what they may have said or not said at that time. They did not testify during the sentencing. They didn't come in, but I think it seems like quite a jump to assume that that means they were not personally harmed. And again, I feel like there's a lot of reasons that child victims, I mean, it's extremely traumatizing to keep going over the events in front of a court, in any kind of courtroom, even a supportive courtroom as a sentencing might be. So I don't think there's really anything you can read into that to mean that these four victims were not uniquely harmed. Plus, I really do think Cohen is telling us that we're actually thinking about the people behind those images, even though they're no longer minors. And, you know, those things have happened in the past.
I had a question about that when you mentioned it last time. Are you saying that there is video? I thought there were two separate types of crimes, as you mentioned. One was child pornography images that were found on a device. And then the other one was masturbating on a video chat with four juveniles. Is that there's video of those four juveniles watching that?
Well, there's two things, I guess, going on. That happened, meaning that happened in real time. There was masturbating while they were both on the camera, the webcam together, I guess. Not in the same room, obviously, but, and then there was also images captured, my reading of the record, there's images captured while that happened. I don't know if those images were shared beyond respondent's laptop. I'm not saying that he disseminated those images, but there were images captured from the live feed that was going on with those victims.
Like a distinction, because when we were asking about whether, and the only reason we thought to ask, or at least the only reason I thought to ask whether we knew anything about harm to the juveniles was just the part from the sentencing court. I think this was an expert psychosexual evaluation submitted to the sentencing court that indicated, quote, the juveniles varied in their reports on remembering or viewing respondent masturbate. So that made me wonder, you know, are there reports of harm? But your response to that seemed to be, well, the images can last forever. And I completely understand that. But now it sounds like you're saying you're not sure if there are any images and if the images were ever distributed in any way, correct?
Well, there's also separate child pornographic images involved in this case.
Understood. And okay. So for that, okay. I completely
okay.
understand.
Okay, I thought maybe I confused the court.
Correct.
I mean,
as to the Omegle, I think is what
that's
it was
what
called,
I've heard it's
specifically for juveniles.
There were images from the actual Omegle chats. We know of maybe four, assuming because there's four victims. There were images captured by respondent. I don't have anything in the record that I read when I read the record here from any of it, meaning either of the psychologists that provided reports or anything that might have been in the pre-sentence report would be confidential. But meaning my reading of it, I don't have any reason to. I was not able to determine that any of those images were shared beyond living in respondent's own laptop computer.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Dunn.
Good afternoon. Thank you. May it please the court. To answer that question that was just posed, I was not involved in the criminal case, although through my career, I've handled many of these type cases, and most of those cases were handled in Morris County. So I'm very familiar with the Morris County Prosecutor's Office, the way they handle these cases. And they evaluate, they're very good at evaluating the cases and each one individually. And clearly, if there were strong victim statements or strong victim statements from family members like mothers or fathers whose daughters were on this website, I think it would have been a much different outcome for Mr. Rafe. This was a case where there were originally nine separate crimes that he was charged with. And ultimately, he pled guilty to an accusation, which was to a third and fourth degree crime with a recommendation of probation. So it's not the type of case where the prosecutor was inundated and overwhelmed with victim statements. And in any case I've ever had with Morris County, they always reach out to victims.
So I'm not suggesting that the answer lies only in the criminal case jacket.
Yes.
The materials that were used and presented in court in a criminal case. Our obligation at this point is to make a determination about protecting the public, protecting clients, and is it reasonable, in light of what we do know about this case, to accept that there's no harm to children from what occurred here?
I think as an overall premise, in society, that anytime there's a sexual crime involving a children, there's a possibility there's harm to a child.
And remember the last phrase, there's a possibility
of... There's always a possibility that there is some harm to a child. But if that were the deciding factor, I think you could almost assume that there's some harm to a child, even if a child is voluntarily on a site like this, which is what happened here.
Is there more than a possibility under the facts that we know here?
We don't know that. We don't know that. We do know that some of the victims didn't even recall it from statements that were made by them, that the evaluator had seen in terms of discovery. So whatever it was very minimal in terms of a victim. And we do know that this was a website where people went on it voluntarily. It was advertised as an over 18 website, but clearly there were children on there who were under the age of 18 who made their way probably by answering questions saying, are you over the age of 18? So we don't have any information about that other than what I've just explained to the court.
Mr. Dunn, is it fair to say that these offenses are strict liability in nature in the sense that it didn't matter whether or not Mr. Rave knew their age or not, that if they in fact were underage, that he would potentially be liable?
Yes, that's true. That is true.
It is his position that he didn't know the ages, that he didn't actually know that any of the victims were underage at the time?
Well, this is a case where he went on a website and these weren't infants. I mean, there are some things out there like that, in my understanding. They were...
Can your voice up?
Yes, perfect. These were teenage girls. For him to ascertain exactly how old they were, he wouldn't be able to do that.
I thought there was something in the record that there wasn't actually even any chat. Like there was no contact with each person. It was just he was, you know, engaging in exhibitionist behavior by masturbating on an app. And it was in whoever's presence happened to come on, but he wasn't individually asking particular people to join a room or anything like that.
That's correct. There was, and that's something that distinguishes this case from many of the cases that are in the DRB reasoning. In many of those cases, the attorneys who were involved knew the victim, knew something about the victim, had discussions with the victim, had contact with the victim, either orally or written. And in some of the cases, they were actually in the presence of the victim. In one of the cases, the attorney was actually representing the mother in a custody case, and he committed an act of a criminal sexual act in front of that child. This is just a random website where there is no contact. Mr. Rave did not select a victim. He did not groom a victim. He did not pursue a victim. And there was never any attempt by Mr. Rave to meet with any of the victims. In almost every one of the cases which attorney was disbarred, it was a case where the attorney either met the victim, was on the way to see the victim, and was apprehended on the way. One case, he had bought the victim plane tickets. There was an overt act or an actual meeting between the attorney and the victim. And those are the cases where there was a disbarment. And it's one of the things that in the DRB's analysis, which was found in pages 22 to 32, it's actually the largest part of their decision. They go through all the case law and they talk about the case law in terms of pre-2014. And then they talk about the cases that occurred after 2014. And then they talk about the most recent case that was involved. And in their analysis, as they go through all these cases, they, on page 27, they talk about addressing all three cases and contrasting Legato and Kenyon with Walter. The court found a significant distinction between online and personal physical contact and noted that in the first two cases, there had been no actual harm or contact to an actual minor, which would require disbarment. And that's really what we have here. There's a distinction between an online and a personal physical contact. There was no personal physical contact. There was no attempt to have a personal contact. And there has been no actual harm or contact with the minor. Again, that's what we have here because we don't know of any. There was none mentioned in the paperwork submitted in the request for a disbarment. I know of none from the criminal case, from what I've read or seen. There's just the propensity or the ability or the possibility that there could be some harm. But there is no actual harm here. There was no victim statements. And as stated, some of the victims didn't even remember. And then if we go on further in the DRB decision, at their very conclusion, after going through all the cases, they say, in closing, we reiterated that in Gillen and Nilsen, we will remain resolute that when an attorney behaves in a manner such as to destroy totally any vestige of confidence, that the individual could ever again practice in conformity with the standards of the profession, the attorney should be disbarred. In this case, I think Mr. Rave, by all his actions from the time this case started to the present, show that he could practice again in conformity with standards of the profession. As stated in his certification, which is part of the my brief, he's deeply regretful that for his actions. He says, they're out of character and I'm extremely embarrassed and I'm ashamed for the decisions I made. And then he goes through in detail his efforts that he has made since the time in therapy, AA meetings, working as a volunteer. And he talks about everything that he's done and will continue to do. One of the things Dr. Singer, who is his treating psychologist, was so impressed with is, despite the fact that he's moved 2 hours away, he still continues to visit him in person. And he does so on a biweekly basis. He is committed to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. He's committed to prove himself to everyone that knew him. As I pointed out in my brief, he has lost everything. He's lost his job. He had a great job. He had a great career. He worked in two of the biggest and best firms in New Jersey. He was married. He lost his marriage. He lost his girlfriend. His children don't speak to him anymore. He's lost most of his friends. He's about as low as you could be in life
from that high, high pedestal that he was on. He was truly a highly accomplished attorney. He did everything right. He went to a great school, went to a great law school, had a clerkship, worked his way up to a corporate lawyer, fabulous job, fabulous income, and he's lost it all. And despite that, he continues to try. He continues to make every effort to restore confidence in people that know him. He's tried to work, couldn't even get a job at Amazon. And he is requesting, and I think he has shown a basis for the request, that he should not be disbarred, that he should be given another chance. It is a case that is, I think, difficult for us all to grasp. It's hard to understand how it could be in this place, but it happened. And he hasn't just ran away. He hasn't, he had problems with substances, and he didn't go back to that. He recommitted himself to AA and NA. He's been in treatment with doctors. He's done everything that he can to make sure this doesn't happen again, and to show the court that he should be given another chance. And I would ask that you do that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Raven, would you like to consult with counsel?
I mean,
would you like to
please come something? To the center?
Come on up.
Thank you for the opportunity to address the court. Like Mr. Dunn said, I'm extremely regretful and embarrassed about my actions. You know, I look back and I like Mr. Dunn said, I sometimes wonder exactly what happened. But I'm working on it. The short thing I'd like to say is I don't live my life like that anymore. I was in a bad place. That's not an excuse. I have been working since then to do everything I can to redeem myself, not only as an attorney, but as a human being. You know, some of the things I'm doing is I'm volunteering a lot of hours. I have a passion for dogs. And I'm literally working hundreds of hours at an animal shelter. I go to 4 to 5 meetings a day in a 12-step program and several 12-step programs. I sponsor other men. I speak at rehabs. I chair meetings. My professional career has suffered greatly, and I'll never get that back, no matter what happens. Even if I retain my license, the type of work I did, I'm never getting that back. I'd like to retain my license, and I understand there's going to be suspension involved, but I would like to get to the point where I can make a living as an attorney. It's the only thing I've been doing for my whole career. You know, I can assure the court that nothing like this is going to happen again. And, you know, regardless, I'd like to say that, you know, I'm going to continue my work in the community and to make myself a better person, regardless of what happens with my career. But I do ask the court to please, you know, allow me an opportunity to retain my license. Thank you.
Questions, anyone? Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess.